Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Azella Santana is the new director of the Orange County Regional History Center in Orlando.
One of my overall visions is really to build more collaborations, connect more with the community, and find ways to grow those connections.
We'll discuss the fascinating but failed theme park, Splendid China.
When the park opened on December 19, 1993, the usual political figures were there along with 3,000 visitors. All were treated to 5,000 years of history in miniature.
And we'll talk about Helen V. Stell and the development of the Tampa Public Library. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Azella Santana is the new manager of the Orange County Regional History Center in downtown Orlando and the new executive director of the Historical Society of Central Florida. Santana got her start professionally at another major institution, the Orlando Museum of Art. There, she worked her way from education assistant to collections and exhibitions coordinator to associate curator.
That was sort of my entree, kind of going into museums. I was then sort of swooped up into curatorial, and that's really where I learned a lot of the day-to-day of working in exhibitions, curating exhibitions throughout the tenure that I was there. I worked really closely with Hanson Mulford, who was the head curator there, and it was a really phenomenal time to be able to learn and grow, but also learn about how we could bring exhibitions that can really connect to the community. He and I worked together and brought the first exhibition of the Florida Prize Exhibition of Contemporary Art, which you might be familiar with. I worked really closely with a lot of, connectors within the community. And it was so much fun to work on that and be able to learn about, how exhibitions can play a role in creating dialogue within the community. One of my favorite exhibitions that I curated there was working with one of the former curators of Art of the Ancient Americas, and we had curated a small exhibition of Taino objects. And it was a really great opportunity for me to learn about how exhibiting these works can really present more information about a culture and about a community, and also about how that aspect of engaging with the objects can really bring about more education in a different way for different generations.
Most recently, Azella Santana served as Director for Advancement at the University of Central Florida's College of Arts and Humanities, where she was in charge of major gifts fundraising. At UCF, Santana developed successful community relationships and collaborations that will be useful in her new position at the Orange County Regional History Center.
That was a phenomenal experience for me. It was something that allowed me to work really closely with the faculty and with the students and really learn about the research that's been happening. And that really is what grew my interest in really expanding, not only just in the visual arts, but going into the performing arts and as well as the humanities, and working really closely with the history faculty and philosophy departments there. So for me, kind of making that step into here, my current role at the History Center, was really something that I'm really excited about. I was able to really build a lot of wonderful connections within the faculty at UCF and see a lot of the collaborative projects that happens across the university, but also within the community.
The Orange County Regional History Center is located in a neoclassical style building in the heart of downtown Orlando. In the late 1990s, following the construction of a new Orange County courthouse, the historic courthouse was repurposed to serve as the History Center. A fire during the renovation provided some challenges, but they were successfully overcome. As Communications Director Scotty Campbell explains, the building was originally constructed in 1927.
It's designed by Murray S. King, who was actually the first architect who was certified in Florida. And there are a few other buildings in downtown that are designed by him as well. The original library, which was called the Albertson Public Library, was designed by Murray S. King. And yeah, it's a very majestic looking building. So definitely, I can tell you, as someone who works here, it gives you a sense of pride as you walk in. I think a unique experience, particularly one thing I think of is our summer camps that we have every year. And I just imagine being a young one walking into a building like this and experiencing it. Also, you know, there is a lot to be said for historic preservation in the area, because there are times when I would say, you know, not to slight my hometown, but there are times when I'm disappointed with Orlando in some of the preservation efforts. But this one has held up and is being very well taken care of. And we have 4 floors of history that goes back 14,000 plus years. We've got a mastodon tooth that you can see. Often people think of history here in Orlando as being from 1971 on, you know, when a certain mouse took up residency. But of course, our history goes back much, much farther than that, even before there were, communities setting up here that there was history. So we cover all that within this very cool, unique building. The courthouse you mentioned has an interesting history. When the building was being renovated for the museum to move in, there actually was a fire in one of the courtrooms. That was the one that we were planning to put on display. So the courtroom that people come to visit is historic. Everything that's in it is authentic, but it was actually pieced together from other courthouses in the building.
It's always interesting to see that. And, my connection with the History Center goes way back. I have 2 young daughters who have gone to summer camps here at the History Museum. One wants to go into civics and, you know, a future lawyer at tow. And for me, it's really great to see the kids come through and have another experience. You know, some of them go and have an experience of a mock trial. You know, these are some of the summer camps that are offered during the sessions when they're out of school. And, you know, for them to have that experience with the collection and be able to see, you know, how does government work? You know, what is it like to be in a courtroom, in a historic courtroom that, you know, has a lot of history, that has probably seen some really interesting cases over the years? You know, what does that look like, and how can we really create another experience for the community at all ages? And that's what's exciting, is, you know, being able to have an opportunity to really showcase that.
The Orange County Regional History Center has permanent exhibits covering prehistory through modern times that are frequently updated and refreshed. There are also rotating exhibit spaces. Azella Santana.
We have one exhibition that's currently open. It's called Our Figurehead Music and Mayhem Exhibition. And that is something that is actually ongoing right now. It closes on February 2nd. So it's a really great time to come see that before it closes. But the great thing about that exhibition is it really kind of talks about more of the Orlando music scene between 1985 and 2001. It was curated by one of our curators, Jeremy, here in our exhibitions department. And it allows us to really kind of rethink, you know, and sort of remember about the bands and the clubs and the community and the chaos that was happening here in the Orlando music scene.
In April, a new exhibit called Orlando Collected will commemorate the 150th anniversary of the city's incorporation. New director Azella Santana's vision for the Orange County Regional History Center includes expanding community outreach and engaging wider audiences with Central Florida history through collaboration with other organizations.
You know, I think sometimes, you know, we can be siloed in our different areas, and we have Central Florida, you know, we have all the different organizations. And for me, it was really exciting to be able to see, like, how can we connect the dots? How can we bring all these different experts in different areas and come together and bring in wonderful programming and collaborations that allow the community to come together in different and more meaningful ways. And so I'm excited my new role here. I am, I think, 4 weeks in. So for me, it's a really exciting time to just really learn as much as I can, not only about the collections here within the History Center and all of the wonderful exhibitions that they bring around and bring and curate within, and also shows that they also bring into the museum. But for me, it's just a really wonderful opportunity to find ways to connect more within the Central Florida community. You know, we represent 6 districts across Orange County, and there's so many great ways to collaborate within within our districts, but also how can we be an extension and a community collaborator with the collections that we have here, and also as a space to connect with different different audiences, different groups. And for me, that's something that's exciting. That's one of my overall visions, is really to build more collaborations, connect more with the community, and find ways to grow those connections through through events, through activities, through you know, building the partnerships that we have with other arts and cultural and historical organizations here in Central Florida.
Azella Santana is the new manager of the Orange County Regional History Center and the new executive director of the Historical Society of Central Florida. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. The 2025 Florida Historical Society Public History Forum will be held May 15th through 17th in Orlando. We'll have interesting panel discussions and presentations and tour historic sites like the Orange County Regional History Center. Find out more at myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Orange and Osceola counties claim the title of Theme Park Central and have done so since the 1980s. In addition to the theme park giants such as Disney World, Universal, and SeaWorld, smaller, more focused parks like Gatorland and Funspot, as well as some historic sites like the Kennedy Space Center, attract sizable niche audiences. In the 1990s, as the Cold War ended, a new contender entered the theme park contest. Splendid China, an all-but-forgotten outdoor museum and miniature, joined other attractions in the secondary market.
Wen Xing Shang, the head of Archives and Special Collections at Rollins College, published his research on Splendid China in the winter 2006 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly. The Florida park was modeled on a newly opened attraction in China with the same name, and like its counterpart, would present the thousands of years of Chinese history and culture in miniature, mimicking the successful Madura Dam Lilliputian land in Holland, which opened in 1952. Florida Splendid China was expected to be a complement to Disney or SeaWorld, a static park rather than a dynamic park, a pensive walkthrough kind of thing. The developers expanded on what they viewed as a proven concept. At home, Splendid China opened in 1989 to rave reviews. With an inexpensive admission price, the park attracted 3.5 million visitors in its first year of operation. Two additions to the park, a Chinese folk cultural village representing the 56 nationalities living in China, and a 119-acre Windows on the World exhibit depicting international historic sites, increased attendance. Florida Splendid China was expected to present the nation's history and culture to new audiences and encourage tourism to China. The international magazine Economist pointed out another potential benefit when it described the Florida venture as, quote, China's headlong plunge into Western-style capitalism, end quote. the Chinese theme park organization, CTS, entered a 50-50 partnership with Chinese-American real estate moguls George and Josephine Chen, who own the 560 acres of land off U.S. Highway 192 west of Disney, where the park would be located. The Chens visualized Splendid China as the centerpiece of a larger development project that would include 500 single-family homes, 240 condo apartments, 1,400 hotel and motel rooms, and more than 300,000 square feet of shopping space.
Connie, breaking into the theme park business is a high bar everywhere, but especially in Central Florida. To even the casual observer, the market would seem to be saturated even in the 1990s.
As Zhang points out, quote, the competition for tourist time in Central Florida has always been fierce, and industry analysts believe that the toughest market to crack may not be the top tier of theme parks, but the secondary market, end quote. The Splendid China partners believed, however, that their attraction, conceived as an outdoor educational museum, would beat the odds. As George Chen explained, quote, if you want to do an attraction at the doorstep of Disney, you need to complement them, not compete with them, end quote. The partners convinced themselves that families would find a more peaceful and educational day at Splendid China and affordable and welcome relief from the nonstop excitement of the larger theme parks. What they hadn't counted on were the multiple controversies that accompanied the construction and operation of the park. The controversies followed three lines of thinking. Critics persistently claimed that the CTS was a government-funded travel agency that abused its Chinese employees. Although the Chinese artists who constructed the exhibits lived and worked on site, the FBI remained convinced that some of the laborers might have been tapped by the Chinese intelligence services to spy on the nearby Cape Canaveral and Kennedy Space Center. Finally, when the park opened, protesters who objected to Chinese presentations of such sites as the Dalai Lama's palace voiced their views at the entrance of the park and on occasion inside the grounds. Two groups were especially vocal, Students for a Free Tibet and Citizens Against Chinese Propaganda. When the park opened on December 19, 1993, the usual political figures were there along with 3,000 visitors. All were treated to 5,000 years of history in miniature. Every aspect of the panorama had been constructed by hand by Chinese artists using authentic materials imported from China. The Great Wall used 6.5 million 1- and 2-inch handcrafted bricks. Tens of thousands of figurines sculpted by Chinese artists dotted the miniature landscape. There was no mass production, no fiberglass, no colored concrete anywhere on the site. The cost of construction, over $100 million, raised the original entry price from the $11 to $16.50 range to $23.55 for adults and $13.90 for children under 13 years of age. The higher price made the park less attractive. American visitors also complained about the restaurants that served authentic Chinese food but did not conform to American tastes. During the first year, attendance averaged 1,000 per day, rising to 2,500 per day on the weekends. 2 weeks after the opening, George Chen sold his share of the park to CTS. It was an ominous sign of things to come. A series of Chinese managers cycled through the park in an effort to bring in more visitors. Restaurant menus were changed to meet American tastes. Marketing strategies to highlight Chinese-American families were initiated. Chinese New Year was celebrated, and performance by dancers and athletes were added. Proposals were submitted for the addition of an Asian-American trade center and a Hong Kong village with shops, restaurants, and entertainment. By 1999, the park had failed to meet its goals, and attendance had dropped to a few hundred visitors a day. The park was losing $9 million annually and was beginning to show neglect with broken and chipped tiles, untrimmed landscaping, and apathetic staff. Florida Splendid China closed in 2003, a decade after its opening. Zhang attributes the demise of the park to a number of factors. CTS Management's fundamental error was the construction of a park based on their own notions of entertainment, rather than a careful study of American tastes, he wrote. That initial error was compounded by poor marketing and advertising campaigns. Frequent changes in management made it impossible to develop long-term strategies. Three hurricanes and the constant voices of protest compounded the management issues. Finally, Splendid China was a victim of 9/11. The attack adversely affected all theme parks, but it proved fatal for Splendid China. Splendid China sold all its property for a reported $40.2 million. As Zhang concludes, quote, after 10 years of struggle, Florida Splendid China regretfully disappeared. Although it led to China's headlong plunge into Western-style capitalism, by any standards, the attraction had been a complete failure. Labeled as the state's most troubled theme park, associated with passive attractions, poor management, and continued protests, it represented only one of the most disastrous overseas investments made by a Chinese company, but a major fiasco in the history of Florida tourism, end quote.
And although it was short-lived, Splendid China was a beautiful and educational park. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this look at the role of Helen V. Stell in the development of the Tampa Public Library.
Rachel Turnka is an instruction and engagement librarian at the University of Central Florida. Her research interests include the history of Florida public libraries and how women like Helen V. Stell played a central role in their development. Few public libraries existed in Florida circa 1900. They remained inaccessible to most of the population and lacked many essential services. As a result, the American Library Association explicitly criticized Florida in its 1907 survey of library conditions across the U.S. as, quote, the most unsatisfactory record for so large a state, end quote.
The American Library Association had done some just general surveys of libraries around the United States, and a lot of the literature and what people were saying was not very complimentary about Southern libraries in general and then Florida libraries in particular. Like, a lot of people were writing about how library services were really deficient in Florida at that time, just not a lot of access for people to public libraries at all. And we were also probably, you know, pretty much later in Florida in terms of getting a state library in comparison to some of the other states. So that was also often noted.
Helen V. Stell served as Tampa Public Library's first director from 1917 to 1947. Originally from Illinois and educated at New York's Pratt Institute, she immediately transformed the library into a functioning space, as the location lacked furniture, books, and funding to maintain its staff and broader operations when it opened in 1917.
She kind of walked into this situation with the library that the library was open, but it didn't have basically any resources or any funding. So, like, there really weren't any books at the time. There wasn't money for staff members. So she had quite a time when she first got here just trying to even figure out, like, how do I open this library to the public? Like, even though the building is completed, how do we actually create a functioning library?
Part of her initiative to create a functioning library included establishing branch libraries, particularly the Harlem branch, which Stell's launched to serve Tampa's Black community, given that the main branch remained segregated. Rather than constructing a separate standalone branch, the city's library board installed the branch in Harlem Academy, the first public school for Black children in Tampa. The scarce funding forced Stell to ask one of the Academy's teachers to serve as its librarian.
The Harlem branch library wasn't a separate standalone. It was actually part of the Harlem Academy, which was a school, and they had a section in there that was devoted to the library. And instead of having, like, a librarian devoted to that, they actually kind of tapped one of the teachers at the academy to help out, basically, as the librarian. So that was 1918 that they had the branch installed at the Harlem Academy. And then eventually in 1923, they voted to move it to the Urban League headquarters just to give it more space. And librarians at the main branch would go to the Harlem branch like once a week and do story times and different programming and things like that.
Additionally, Stell started bookmobile services across Tampa in 1930, offering an apt lens to understand broader depression conditions and the library's function within that context.
The bookmobile, thinking about late 1920s, early 1930s, about serving kind of during the Depression, when you have people who can't maybe physically come into the library because there's a gas shortage or they don't have a car or, you know, whatever it may be, instead going to actual places like going to parks where families could come together and they could check out materials. And kind of the interesting thing about libraries during the Depression, and this isn't just in Florida or in the South, it's kind of nationwide, is the demand for library services and library materials skyrocketed. So like the highest circulation that the library had seen since it was opened, you know, was during the Depression, because people want to be educating themselves, you know, thinking about ways that they can maybe find other employment or even just leisure, you know, like ways to kind of escape from maybe the harsh realities of every day and just open up a book and, you know, kind of read a novel and do it that way.
Stell published the Florida Library Survey in 1935, the first comprehensive survey exclusively about Florida libraries. Her findings raised awareness about the state of Florida libraries in the 1930s, and the study more broadly set a precedent for researching and improving Florida library conditions.
The need for more funding for libraries, funding not just for resources like the books and the services, but also thinking about the staff and the training of librarians. And this is a question that's going on not just, you know, in Florida, but also nationwide, about what kind of credentials and what kind of training librarians as a profession should have. And saying especially that the state needed to do some investing, because at the time there wasn't a state library board, and kind of the Florida Library Association sort of took on the responsibilities of maybe what in other states a state library board would have done. So she was calling upon the state to invest more at the state level in creating an infrastructure for, you know, a public library system, and also for college libraries too. Certainly raised awareness about what the current state of, you know, things were, and helped to kind of pave the way. There was another survey done later, again, through someone through the Florida Library Association, kind of following in her footsteps. So I think she helped to almost start a precedent of the need for doing these surveys, just to get an idea of, instead of, you know, hearsay, to get some real data about, you know, what libraries were doing and what kind of resources and services were offered.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.